Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. A new briefing paper co-published by the Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestine Legal maps the historical and political context for the current criminalization of solidarity activism and organizing against Israel's genocide in Gaza. The paper, Anti-Palestinian at the Core, The Origins and Growing Dangers of U.S. Anti-Terrorism Law, highlights the way in which many foundational anti-terrorism laws arose during or were adapted to pivotal moments in the Palestinian liberation struggle, often pushed by Israel-aligned groups to reflexively cast the veil of terrorism almost uniquely on Palestinians. In just the past few months, Palestine Legal writes, the Anti-Defamation League has called on university presidents to investigate Students for Justice in Palestine chapters for, quote, material support for terrorism, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis used the same rationale to order a ban of SJPs from the state's public universities, a move that a federal court recognized would likely violate the First Amendment. Efforts to defund the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, have invoked these same support for terrorism laws. Joining us to talk about this report and how it can help instruct students, activists, and policymakers to use and protect free speech rights is one of its lead authors and researchers, Daryl Lee. He is an associate professor of anthropology and social sciences and a lecturer in law at the University of Chicago. Daryl, I've been a fan of yours for very long, and it's really great to have you with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Nora. It's great to be with you.
So in the introduction to the briefing paper, you and your colleagues write, quote, as the more notorious U.S. policies of the post-9/11 era, such as torture, indefinite detention, and targeted killing abroad, fade from public memory, these older anti-terrorism laws have been normalized as a comparatively liberal baseline, their structurally anti-Palestinian character having been obscured in the meantime. And in the briefing, there's a list of examples of this history, documenting how early U.S. anti-terrorism legislation evolved specifically to oppose Palestinian liberation struggles and solidarity efforts for those. Let's lay out the origin story of the current moment we're in terms of accepted and widespread anti-Palestinian policies and legislation, and why it's important to understand where and why it began. What can you tell us about this history?
Well, I think the best place to start as far as like this, the word terrorism has an older origin, many other usages. It wasn't invented out of thin air in this context, but so, for example, in the early 20th century, transnational anarchists and other left movements were often talked about in terms of terrorism, and there were even some international treaties that were put together during that time. But really, the kind of what I think of as like the modern era for the terrorism concept really comes out of the mid to late 1960s. And there, of course, you have all of the kind of new left movements, both anti-colonial movements in the global south and also left movements in sort of Euro-America, right? So thinking of groups like the Black Panther Party, the Weathermen, or in Europe, groups like the Red Army Faction, also known as the Baader-Meinhof Gang, Action Directe in France. So, but Palestine really becomes the sort of key figure in a lot of these debates. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One, I think, is that the Palestinian national struggle was an anti-colonial movement, but unlike a lot of other anti-colonial movements around that time, think of like Algeria, Vietnam, it was conducting armed struggle largely from outside of the historic homeland. Of course, there were Palestinians living under Zionist colonial rule at the time, but in the 60s, a lot of the action, as it were, in the armed struggle was really taking place in the diaspora, right? So in the frontline states, Lebanon, Jordan, but also with sort of armed operations happening in Europe and in other parts of the world. So the thing about Palestinian armed resistance was that it was always already kind of internationalized in that time period. And because of that, it gave the Israeli state kind of a reason to go around to its allies in Europe and the United States and say, look, this is a problem that isn't only directed at us, it also implicates your interests. And this was an argument that was sort of convincing to American policymakers because they saw these groups as, or they saw the Palestinian Revolution as not only a threat to its key ally in the region, but also a threat to its Arab client regimes. So all states like to call their opponents terrorists and to label them that way. And, you know, I think the Israelis just happened to be very successful at it, in part because they were so successful in expelling so much of the indigenous population, right, that they were dispossessing. And that kind of like internationalized, if you will, the Palestinian struggle. It internationalized it in good ways, right? Like the incredible solidarity across the third world that the PLO was able to build up, the fact that the Palestinian struggle was able to result in representation at the international level in the United Nations. But then the flip side, the negative side of that internationalization was being kind of described and smeared actually as terrorists and also really as like the archetypal terrorist. So there are all these groups. So if you think about the United States, there's a lot of groups that are called terrorists. Like the terrorism label operates rhetorically. It kind of becomes a policy instrument. But really, when we talk about putting the terrorism term into law and like writing new laws with new governmental powers, it's primarily about Palestine and not so much about these other movements. And that, again, reflects the way that the U.S. saw the Palestinian Revolution as a kind of transnational threat to its interests around the world. For example, calling the Black Panther Party terrorists was something that was done. And of course, you know, rhetorically, they were labeled as such, but the actual legal instruments used to repress them were part of the already existing and very ample structures of white supremacy in kind of the domestic U.S. context, right? So it's not as if they necessarily needed like a new set of laws or a new set of legal concepts in order to enact that repression. So anyway, that's part of why I think the Palestinian case is special and then becomes like a prototype that the US then improvises on, adds to, and expands to other contexts, right? So then the terrorism sort of label and the terrorism policy and legal structure begins to get adapted elsewhere. So Palestine is, you know, you can think of it as like a laboratory, a canary in a coal mine. There's all sorts of metaphors that people often use, right? But it was really the main case, the case that was uppermost in mind when the key developments in U.S. terrorism law unfolded in the decades before 9/11. So one really straightforward example of this is that the first time the word terrorism appears in federal law is in 1969. And it's very relevant today because it's a statute that restricts U.S. Funding to UNRWA. And the law, I forget the exact wording, but it basically says that funding can't go to UNRWA. It can't be used or can't be directed to people who receive training from the Palestine Liberation Army or engage in acts of international terrorism. Now, that term, international terrorism, isn't actually defined in the law, right? So the law just treats terrorism and being part of the Palestine Liberation Army as essentially synonyms. And that's the pattern that we see going forward. There's often this thing that people say that like, oh, terrorism is really hard to define. One man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's all true. But what's really important to understand about the way states use terrorism as a concept is that they don't really define it as much as they designate it, right? So the whole technology of like having a list of groups. So instead of having an abstract debate about what counts as terrorism or what doesn't, we just have a governmental body that says, okay, here's a list. The following people or groups on this list are labeled as terrorists, and you know, because we say so, right? So that technology or that technique also develops out of the Palestine context. So the first terrorism list from the U.S. government is the state sponsors of international terrorism list that emerges from the late 70s onward. And again, it was very much directed at states in the Middle East and North Africa that were seen as supportive of the Palestinian liberation struggle, especially the so-called rejectionist factions, right? So like the PFLP and so on. Out of the 8 countries that have ever been designated by the U.S. as state sponsors of terrorism, 6 have been in the Middle East region. And getting off the list, one of the major ways in which you can get off the list is by recognizing the state of Israel, which is what we saw with Sudan in 2021. In 1987, the first time, the only time Congress declared a group to be a terrorist organization was the PLO. And that was a special law that was basically enacted in an attempt to shut down the PLO's offices in the United States. And it actually wasn't successful. It wasn't successful with regard to the U.S. mission, the PLO mission to the United Nations. The first time the term terrorism appears in immigration law is in 1990. And there again, the definition of terrorist activity, one of its examples includes being an officer or a spokesperson for the PLO. So again, we see this attempt to render Palestinian and or the Palestinian struggle as synonymous with terrorism. In 1992, the first law that allows for private lawsuits on terrorism accusations was also passed with the PLO explicitly in mind. So essentially the idea was to target whatever assets the PLO had in the United States at that time and to make them subject to legal proceedings. And we can maybe talk more about those private lawsuits later, because that entire strain of litigation is very much connected to sort of Americans who go off and exercise colonial privileges in Palestine. In 1995, you have the first terrorism assets blacklist, the first terrorism financial sanctions blacklist. This was issued in an executive order from President Clinton, and it was basically an attempt to support the Oslo negotiation process. So the name of the list was terrorist groups that threaten the Middle East peace process. This was basically a sop to the Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, because he was facing very difficult electoral chances. The list included basically the Palestinian factions that rejected Oslo, as well as one sort of extreme right-wing Zionist group for the appearance of balance. It actually lists two groups, but the two names are synonyms for the same Kahanist organization. It includes Hezbollah, of course, and it included two Egyptian armed opposition groups. So that was a favor to the regime of Hosni Mubarak. And in fact, that list, because it was the first list of terrorist organizations for the purposes of freezing assets, that when the first time the United States government officially designated Al-Qaeda as a terrorist organization, it was by adding them to the list that was meant to support Oslo, right? So the first time the U.S. government writes Al-Qaeda into law as a terrorist organization, it does so under the pretext or the rationale that it's a group that is, quote, threatening the Middle East peace process, right? Even though Al-Qaeda's like, that was not an area that they were active in. But it just became, it was the tool that was available at the time. So it became the one that was easily applicable to other situations. And I should mention that the context of the 90s is really when groups such as the Anti-Defamation League in the United States, in concert with the government of Israel, really start pushing the US government to crack down on perceived supporters of Hamas in the United States.
Right.
So the arrest of Mohammed Salah from Chicago, from Bridgeview, was a big sort of case in this sort of in this story. And so the ADL had a wish list essentially of legislation that they wanted imposed. They wanted the U.S. to pass laws that would crack down on fundraising or other forms of support for Palestinian resistance groups, and that would make it easier to deport or exclude non-citizens, and a bunch of other things, but those were the two sort of main things. So this executive order was kind of like an initial concession to these demands by the ADL, but then the real sort of prize came about the following year. So in 1996, the government passed a law that criminalized so-called material support to foreign terrorist organizations. So that was the main thing that the ADL was lobbying for. That law created the foreign terrorist organizations list, the FTO list. And essentially, if a group gets put on that list, then if you provide them with any kind of assistance, and assistance is really broadly construed, right? It includes things that normally would be not unlawful, protected by the First Amendment. But if you provide assistance to those groups, you can be put in prison. And if you are a member of one of those groups, you can be deported more easily than otherwise. And the charge of materially supporting these groups is the most common, I believe, charge used in federal terrorism cases. So after 9/11, it's kind of like the prosecutor's favorite go-to toy to throw against all of the sort of American Muslims that they, most of them, you know, they entrapped in sort of like sting operations, concocted plots, and so on. But the material support charge is this extremely broad and pro-prosecutorial instrument, which we have the ADL to thank for that.
Amazing. And, I mean, yeah, I'm just thinking about, you know, for example, the Holy Land Five.
Yes.
Which was the largest Muslim charity organization in the U.S. And the U.S. government, right after 9/11, went after the heads of the Holy Land Foundation, which were giving money to the same organizations in Palestine that USAID was also given money. There was no evidence. Of course, I mean, the whole thing, it's still like mind-blowing that these elders are still languishing in maximum security prisons for helping Palestinian refugees and for helping victims in the U.S. Of tornadoes and the Oklahoma City bomb. I mean, it's extraordinary. And they used material support for terrorism law to shutter the organization, seize their assets, and send them to dungeons.
Yep. So So part of the pattern that we see here is that the early sort of crackdown is really focused on the frontline states, right? So like the state sponsors of terrorism list. So and then it gradually moves inward to the domestic core, right? So then you have like immigration law and kind of preventing people from entering the United States. And then finally in the 90s, you have the material support statute, which you can then use to criminally charge US citizens. So in a way, it's kind of like bringing the war home, right? From the front line in the areas of confrontation with the Zionist regime, all the way to Palestinian diaspora groups that are like thousands of miles away. And of course, in doing so, you know, eroding sort of the basic constitutional rights that, you know, all citizens, right, not just Palestinian Americans, enjoy. So that's obviously a really disturbing pattern in all of this. The other thing that's, you know, that is important about this early 2000s moment is that, you know, when after 9/11 and after like all of these new laws like the Patriot Act and whatever get passed, prosecutors are sort of like, you know, they're eager to like look for, you know, cases where they can easily score convictions. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that the number of actual supporters or affiliates of groups like Al-Qaeda in the United States at that time was like pretty close to zero. But the number of people who were very politically engaged and active and involved for Palestine was non-trivial. And those are the people who became the sort of easy scapegoats. So, and of course, Zionist organizations had already been badgering the US government to prosecute these people for, you know, basically throughout the 1990s. So that's why the early post 9/11 terrorism prosecutions tended to focus on Palestinians, right? So not only the Holy Land Foundation case, also you have the Texas part of it, you have the Chicago part of it, but then you also have the case involving Samuel Ariane and his co-defendants in Florida. After the first like 5-7 years of the so-called war on terror, then you see a lot more of these terrorism cases being applied to other populations. And in a weird way, there's almost like the Justice Department kind of loses interest in Palestine in a way, and also because the chilling effect has happened. It worked. The prosecutions, you know, destroyed these organizations. They destroyed the lives of those who were working in them, and they also sent a strong signal for the Palestinian American community, but also for activists in general to sort of, you know, they all had to like reconfigure their practices around this repressive terrorism regime. So that affected everything in terms of like fundraising, solidarity delegations. And, you know, and then also, I mean, then when you fast forward to the to the investigations in the Twin Cities around 2010, right? These were investigations of anti-war activists, pro-Palestine activists, that indirectly led to the prosecution and eventual deportation of Rasmi Oude, a pillar of the Palestinian community in Chicago. The really important lesson about that story is that a terrorism investigation need not lead to a terrorism prosecution, but it can still turn someone's life upside down, right? So there's a book actually that a defense attorney has written called Three Felonies a Day, making the argument that the federal criminal code is incredibly broad and expansive. And once the FBI is kind of looking into your life, turning things upside down, it's not that hard for them to find something that you or a loved one, someone you care about, has done, even like a trifling, you know, infraction of the federal criminal code, that can then become the basis for very, very, you know, coercive and harsh consequences. This is a very sordid history, of course. And what's crazy is that the debates of the past 20 years around the so-called war on terror that focused on these really spectacular, high attention, high visibility forms of violence, like drone assassinations, Guantanamo, that the sort of like the mainstream critique of these policies has been to say, no, America has to return to the rule of law. And what they meant by that was to sort of rely on and to really vindicate these anti-Palestinian laws that were passed in the 1990s, right? So the logic of the argument is, these laws are okay because they were passed by Congress, right? As opposed to things that were done sort of, you know, so there's kind of like this American elite intra debate about, you know, who has the, you know, whose vote counts in how you deal violence onto Black and brown populations, essentially. But what gets lost in all of that is that even the so-called normal, quote unquote, federal legislation is also incredibly repressive. And yes, as this report shows, has the repression of Palestinian liberation as one of its primary intended targets.
Yeah. Wow. It's shocking, but also not shocking when we look at kind of historical legislation and animus toward Palestinians and those who support the liberation struggle.
Yeah, I want to say that I imagine that for a lot of the EI audience, nothing in the report will be that surprising. but just to plead for like some kind of relevance, what is surprising to me is that the dots have not been connected very much before. Yeah. And there's a lot of interesting reasons for that we can get into, right? But there aren't, I mean, some people have done a little bit of this work, but the whole reason why we wrote this report was we were trying to map the threats of terrorism law to Palestine organizing. And in doing so, we realized that not only were there a bunch of laws that are, you know, dangerous and terrible and repressive, but whenever we looked into the history of these laws, it came up again and again and again that Palestine was the motivating factor, right? So it's not simply a coincidence that these laws happen to be obstacles to Palestine organizing. That's their entire intended purpose in the first place.
Yeah. Let's talk about how this manifests on college campuses, which have been flashpoints for anti-Palestinian lobbying efforts for decades. Israel lobby groups have explicitly called on university administrations to spy on and prosecute students who engage in Palestine solidarity organizing. These groups have helped launch smear campaigns with backing and support of lawmakers to harass and threaten students, primarily Palestinian or Arab students, of course. How have lobby groups and lawmakers employed anti-terrorism laws to silence campus activism specifically, especially over the last 5 months of this genocide in Gaza?
Yeah, so this is probably not a great analogy, but the way I think of, but we have to, there's two different discursive weapons that are being used, right? There's the anti-Semitism one and the terrorism one, but they operate somewhat differently. I think of them a little bit like the relationship. This is the part of the analogy that may not work, but I think of it a little bit like the relationship between like conventional weapons and nuclear weapons, in the sense that the anti-Semitism allegations, the weaponization of anti-Semitism, that is the like bread and butter daily instrument, right? That's used to suppress activism on campuses and just in general throughout society. The laws and policies around anti-discrimination, like Title VI, that is where most of the action is happening in terms of repression and pushback to repression. And that's a separate conversation. But I want to just emphasize that's where most things are happening. The terrorism stuff is not like a day-to-day part of the repressive environment on the campus. But that doesn't mean it's not important. And that's why the nuclear analogy comes into play. It operates as like this lurking threat in the background. So the ADL and the Brandeis Center, which is another one of these, it's like a Zionist activist litigation front. They sent this letter to over 200 university leaders back in October, calling on them to investigate their campus chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine for material support to terrorism. That is not like a credible or a serious threat, because look, you're like average dean of students in a university. It's not like within their areas of competence to be conducting investigations under federal criminal law, right? So, but I mean, the ADL, they're not stupid. Like, they know that their letter is not going to make people, you know, do the thing that they ask for. What the purpose of a letter like that is to really increase a kind of atmospherics of fear. Right. And to encourage indirect forms of repression, like, for example, increasing cooperation between campus security forces and law enforcement. Right. Or there's also right now, I forget what it's called exactly, but like a Homeland Security Advisory Council that's like trying to influence policies of universities across the board to adapt more surveillance of online activism, things like that. And there's some attempts to get legislation passed around expanding terrorism stuff. So, for example, in Indiana, there is a bill that was introduced that would require state universities to come up with policies to ensure that none of their funds go to people who are, quote unquote, associated with terrorist organizations or state sponsors of terrorism. Obviously, associated is, there's no real definition. It's extremely broad. You could read it to mean, you know, a citizen of Iran can't get a scholarship, right? So that bill is under consideration. And again, even if it doesn't pass, one of the things we learned in this history is that a lot of these repressive laws that we see, at the time when they were being debated in Congress, there were even crazier laws that were kind of that were proposed, right? So what often happens is you pay attention to like the, if like to take a boxing analogy, you pay attention to like the right hand, right? But then the left hand is the one that's actually going to come and sort of do the damage. So yes, there's like really crazy and outlandish legislative proposals, super racist on their face, because in Congress, there's this dynamic of like a race to the bottom and grandstanding in racism against Palestinians. But that should not distract us from the other proposals that comparatively might seem more moderate, but are actually more likely to get passed and to do damage. And in fact, that's actually how the instrument of terrorism lists got created. So what tended to happen historically was that people in Congress wanted to write into the law things like the PLO is a terrorist organization, the Palestinians are terrorists, and so on and so forth. And because that was a way of showing to their to sort of Zionist constituencies that they cared about, that they were like being, you know, really extra, right? The executive branch tended to resist these kind of measures, not because they were less anti-Palestinian at all, but because putting that kind of thing into statute actually limits the flexibility and the discretion of the bureaucracy and the intelligence agencies and so on, right? So they don't want a law that says who the terrorists are. What they want is a law that gives them the power to decide who is a terrorist and who is not, and to take people off the list as a potential carrot, right? So So the compromise in 1979 in the Export Administration Act that was proposed by Senator Jacob Javits, who was like a major Zionist figure at the time, he was the one who came up with the idea of like, okay, look, we've been passing laws saying that, you know, aid should not go to terrorists, but we don't define what terrorists are. Let's put into law the idea that the Secretary of State is the one who has the power to put the terrorism label on someone, right? Like that is actually... it isn't as sexy from the point of view of like grandstanding and saying, hey, we passed a law that called Palestinians terrorists, but it's actually much scarier, much more effective because it develops a mechanism and a machinery. And that is how terrorism moves from being a rhetorical smear that you put on people to a term that has legally operationalizable consequences, right? It actually becomes a weapon in the tools of the bureaucracy at that point.
Absolutely. That is Daryl Lee. He's one of the lead authors of a new report co-published by Palestine Legal and the Center for Constitutional Rights called Anti-Palestinian at the Core, The Origins and Growing Dangers of U.S. Anti-Terrorism Law. Daryl, just in the last week or so, you tweeted about two Zionist groups that have sued the U.S. National Committee of UNRWA. Here's the tweet. The UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, on accusations of supporting terrorism, the latest chapter in a longer history of Zionist lawfare in U.S. courts, you write. Can you talk about who's behind this lawsuit and what it tells us about these lawfare organizations that are directly tied to Israel's foreign affairs ministry at the, right now?
Yeah, so one of the groups that's litigating the case is the International Legal Forum, I think that's what it's called. Mm-hmm. It's an organization that's based in Tel Aviv, and it has received a major grant from the Strategic Affairs Ministry. And it, you know, its function is essentially to combat BDS and other forms of Palestine solidarity activism, especially in the United States. How it operates is pretty shadowy. We don't have a lot of details, but yeah, they're the ones they're one of the groups that's bringing the case. You know, it's very, so just so folks are aware, UNRWA is a UN body, right? It receives most of its money from governments. UNRWA USA is a nonprofit in the United States that raises money from just individuals to give to UNRWA. Now, personally, in my opinion, it's kind of crazy that such a body even exists because, you know, it shouldn't be up to individuals to be funding UNRWA, but that's a story for another day. But really, it's because of all these repressive terrorism laws, you know, there's a lot of fear around donating to humanitarian and charitable activities in Palestine. So UNRWA USA has been widely seen as like one of the safer or maybe even the safest way for people to make donations to support, you know, financially, if that's what they want to do, without running afoul of these sort of terrorism laws. So this lawsuit obviously wants to disrupt that state of affairs, and we have to understand it as part of the broader genocidal effort to defund UNRWA and use starvation as a weapon of war against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned, we just have a few minutes left, but you mentioned some of the groups that this report spotlights in terms of their working relationship with the U.S. government and the Israeli government officials in drafting this kind of policy. The Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, for example, which viewers and listeners of this podcast will be familiar with, of course. It's an Israel lobby group that masquerades as a civil rights organization. And for decades, the ADL has been one of the most, as you mentioned, one of the most pernicious groups working to defame and spy on, slander and smear campaigners for Palestinian rights. And in this moment of genocide in Gaza, the ADL has doubled down in its efforts to conflate criticism of Israel and the Zionist project with anti-Jewish bigotry. They've released all these reports saying that, you know, instances of so-called anti-Semitism are up, you know, 300-500% when, you know, you look at the data points and they're, you know, like candlelight vigils for the children who've been slaughtered by Israel with U.S. weapons, stuff like that. Can you talk about the ADL as an example of a group that launders anti-free speech efforts through these U.S. anti-terrorism laws?
Yeah, so the ADL was really a key player in a lot of the laws that we discussed in the report. And we really focus on the period of the late 80s through the 90s, which is also the period when the ADL's own illegal domestic espionage operations against not only Palestinian groups, but anti-apartheid groups, labor organizations, where that that scandal was also happening. And the ADL was being exposed and they were in litigation around that. They had to pay a settlement. But while they were doing that, they were also lobbying intensely for these repressive anti-terrorism laws. So as I mentioned earlier, the law that allows for private lawsuits for terrorism, the ADL lobbied very intensely for that. And the material support statute, the most important of these terrorism laws, was at the top of the ADL wish list throughout the 90s. And it almost didn't happen. So the story is that in 1995, there was the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City by two sort of U.S. white domestic extremists. And the result of that was a series of laws that rapidly and dramatically scaled up state repression, primarily against Black and brown communities and against Palestinians and Muslims. So what happened was that the Clinton administration decided to take advantage of the outrage after the Oklahoma City bombing to pass anti-terrorism legislation. And what they did was they took the ADL wish list, right? So the laws that would criminalize sort of Palestine support or Palestine liberation work. And they also had a bunch of other laws that are the kinds of things you would expect to see in an anti-terrorism bill. So laws that more strictly regulated explosives and firearms, laws pertaining to wiretapping, things like that. And the Republican-led House of Representatives gutted that bill. And because that, you know, they saw the sort of militia groups that carried out Oklahoma City as basically their constituency. So they threw all that stuff out. And then in the name of anti-terrorism, they put all of their sort of longstanding anti-crime, quote unquote, anti-immigration, quote unquote, initiatives. So a lot of the policy, a lot of the laws that like rapidly accelerated the federal death penalty, which of course is disproportionately used against Black and brown people, laws that dramatically scaled up the practice of immigration detention and deportation. Folks may not remember this, but even in the early 1990s, the number of people being held in immigration detention in the United States at any given time was like maybe a few hundred or a few thousand. It was really this moment in the mid-1990s where that, you know, parallel prison system begins to explode as a result of this law. So what happened was that the ADL started ringing alarm bells. The Democrats started ringing alarm bells. And they said, you know, the Republicans have completely thrown out this anti-terrorism legislation, they replaced it with something else. And at the very least, can you put back in the parts that are about suppressing Palestine liberation work? So all of the other things that they originally wanted, they just kind of gave up on. But the ADL organized a letter that was signed by a bunch of other major Zionist organizations. And you know, this is not a secret, like they bragged about it, they put out press releases. And even the Republicans realized that they kind of had gone too far. Like Newt Gingrich, the Republican leader at the time, was like, oh, well, maybe, you know, we can like roll back some of what we did. I'm especially interested in these parts about international terrorism. So it's really a reminder of how anti-Palestinian animus is a really strong area of bipartisan consensus in Washington. So the final bill was basically the Republican anti-crime, anti-immigration bill. And with the Clinton administration / ADL anti-Palestinian parts of the law put back in. And that's how the material support statute and the foreign terrorist organization list found their way into the law.
Fascinating. Absolutely. And yeah, it just shows, what the intentions of these laws have always been. At the end of the briefing paper, there's a list of recommendations for policymakers, lawyers, university administrators, journalists, activists. Can you talk about some of the recommendations here and how this briefing paper can be used to protect defenders of Palestinian rights here in the U.S.?
Yeah, the recommendations are pitched at kind of the broadest possible level because we recognize that a lot of different kinds of people might be reading this and running with it, hopefully, in their own ways. I mean, one obvious point of commonality that follows from what we were just talking about is that folks should not be taking the ADL as a credible source on anything pertaining to sort of so-called terrorism. So that's one thing that's really important. There, you know, obviously we have to resist any possible further expansion of terrorism laws, and we should also be building towards their abolition. And that's a longer term goal that I want more people in the movement to be thinking about kind of concretely, because these laws are a structural and concrete impediment to our organizing. And they're also just extremely harmful to, you know, many, many constituencies beyond the movement, right? So it's also a way of potentially kind of building relations with other folks. So that's important. I think what it, for the, this is maybe a little bit more niche, but is worth mentioning. There is something about the critical discussion around the war on terrorism in the United States over the past 20 years, especially in legal circles, but also journalists and activists. There's been a strange kind of like silo effect where Palestine tends to be not very present in those conversations. And you could say that, you know, there's a way in which some Palestine conversations have sort of avoided war on terrorism stuff as well, right? So there's a strange incentive structure where everyone is trying to like compete for the attention and sympathy of like white liberals. And then that creates this sort of like effect of artificial disconnect and separation. So one of the other things that we really hope comes out of this is that for people who are really working on war on terrorism, Islamophobia, anti-Muslim animus issues, that they also understand the centrality of Palestine to the policies that they're fighting against. A lot of people, I think, are aware of this, but maybe don't have the language to articulate this. And maybe this paper will help fill in some of those gaps. And other people, I think, are maybe making a more intentional strategic decision that like, oh, if we talk about Palestine, if we include Palestine, that will somehow make our work more difficult. And I think that's something that we have to sort of debate further, because I don't think that's the right way forward. And you know, I hope that, you know, that a publication like this will really help people understand why that's the case.
Absolutely. And again, the publication is Anti-Palestinian at the Core: The Origins and Growing Dangers of U.S. Anti-Terrorism Law. It's a briefing paper that was just published in February, co-published by Palestine Legal and the Center for Constitutional Rights, and one of its lead authors, Daryl Lee. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this. Where can people read your work and this paper?
Well, this paper is available on both the websites of CCR and PAL Legal, so pretty easy to find.
Great. And on Twitter, what's your Twitter handle?
Oh, right. I'm DCLI on Twitter.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And we'll, of course, have a link to the briefing paper and the ways that you can read more of Daryl's work on the blog post that accompanies this broadcast on electronicintifada.net. Daryl Lee, it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much for all of your work and for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Nora. Really appreciate it.